beginning in the early 1900s and lasting into the 1970s, some 65,000 people were forcibly sterilized in the United States. In a new book from Knopp, Harry Brunius investigates how that happened and how the science of eugenics gained the support of some of our most respected leaders to become a powerful force in a country where civil liberties are prized. Better for All the World, The Secret History of Forced Sterilization and America's Quest for Racial Purity has brought Mr. Brunius to my show today. Welcome.
It's a pleasure to be here.
Who performed these sterilizations?
They were done in mainly in mental institutions and in hospitals all around the country. 30 states had passed forced sterilization laws, and they normally were happened in these in mental institutions as well.
Paid for by
the
state governments.
It was absolutely paid for by the state.
And who decided which people should get sterilized?
It would vary. In the early, before Buck v. Bell in 1927. There were legal challenges to many of the sterilization laws, and they would one of the issues that they raised was due process, and because before perhaps it would just be a doctor that would decide this person should be sterilized for eugenic reasons, and so then they began in each institution panels, hearings. They would try to do due process with the patient, and before that they would forcibly sterilize them. So.
Does it turn out that more women or men were sterilized? In retrospect, does it turn out that some ethnic groups were targeted more than others?
Before World War II, it was, I'd like to call it an intra-race racism. They were really trying to purify the white race. They felt that other races, Jews, blacks, etc., weren't the problem, that they were already genetically inferior, so that to purify the white race, you wanted to get rid of the dross, get rid of the problems that was going on, the white alcoholics, the white prostitutes, the white feeble-minded especially.
And then that changed after World War I.
Well, after World War II, then you see in some states that the forced sterilization statutes were used, in particular in the South, as a social weapon against blacks, black women in particular.
But then at that time, much of this had been eliminated because people were horrified by what they had seen in Germany.
Yes.
And were people making the connection in this country?
Yes. There was I have a quote in the book from one of the superintendents in Vermont who addressed, you know, how the Nazi barbarism took it too far, but we can't let it lose track to do it in an enlightened way. And so his problem with what happened in Nazi Germany was that they actually just, they went a little too berserk.
Well, when you look at some of the people who believed in it, the list is kind of shocking. We're talking about Teddy Roosevelt,
absolutely.
Alexander Graham Bell, H.L. Mencken, George Bernard Shaw, Margaret Sanger, the New York Times supported, H.G. Wells, Winston Churchill.
Yes.
And Oliver Wendell Holmes. You mentioned the court case Buck versus Bell, in which the Supreme Court ruled that people could, in fact, be sterilized against their will. And Oliver Wendell Holmes, who many people think was the greatest American jurist of
absolutely.
All time, wrote the majority opinion. What was his argument?
Well, he, as a legal argument, he even mentions forced vaccination as one way to, you know, if you're talking about social health, and if the quote, better for all the world, you know, he says it's better for all the world if rather than to allow those who are manifestly unfit from continuing their own kind. So in a social sense, that it would be better just to sterilize them. And they saw it as a humane and very enlightened way to get rid of social problems.
He wrote, three generations of imbeciles are enough.
Interesting, because that is factually incorrect. Kerry Buck was diagnosed as a moron, not as an imbecile. In the taxonomy of the time, there were idiots and imbeciles, and they were by definition either someone who was mentally incapacitated they couldn't speak, that was an idiot. An imbecile was at the mental age, but this is before mental age was an issue, of perhaps three or four. And around 1916, Henry Herbert Goddard in New Jersey brought the Simon Binet tests from France, translated them into English, and used them to identify who he called morons. And they would have a mental age of, say, 12, 13, and 14. And the issue here was that Goddard said that normally you would never know that they have this taint. And this is the dangerous class that, you know, the people on the street wouldn't know. Only the experts who had these new mental tests could discern that morons were the ones causing all of these problems.
So morons was a construct of the eugenicists.
Absolutely.
Were there any dissenting votes in Buck versus Bell?
It was an 8-1 decision. I forget the name of the dissenting justice. He was a Roman Catholic. And so he didn't write in a dissenting opinion. I don't recall if he did or not.
Well, you say Roman Catholic because among the most vocal opponents were religious groups.
They were. Billy Sunday was a vocal critic of eugenics. And the Catholic Church was the battle line against eugenics began with the Catholic Church in many states, in most states, actually.
What kind of effect did Buck versus Bell have on the pace of sterilization?
The pace exploded after Buck v. Bell, both in terms of the number of people sterilized and in the number more states started passing sterilization laws.
My guest is Harry Bruinius, Bruinius. His book, Better for All the World, taken from Oliver Wendell Holmes' decision, The Secret History of Forced Sterilization and America's Quest for Racial Purity. It's published by Knopf. This is WNYC 93.9 AM 820. We're online at WNYC.org. What kinds of procedures were used to sterilize these people, but in effect to change their lives? The same sort of thing that we would see with a dog or a cat?
It's interesting. America, the land of technological innovation, sterilization in males was developed in Indiana in the late 19th century, and almost by accident. And it was a surgeon named Ochsner, and he said, "Here's a way," because at the time there was a castration movement in the Midwest, in Kansas and in Indiana, and it was vehemently opposed by many people, not simply Roman Catholics and others. They thought it was a brutal, inhumane way of treating criminals. And so he said, "Here's this new thing I discovered. We can keep them from having children." And this is when the idea of genetics and heredity, that things were passed on, it was very new. Evolution and Darwin was new. And so they started to think that, okay, these are heritable traits that are passed on. Here's a way of being both humane and cutting off this defective germplasm, they called it in the late 19th, early 20th century, before the term genes and genetics were coined.
You write that some people weren't even made fully aware that they'd been sterilized.
Yes. There are many instances, and many you can surmise. Scholars have pointed out that statistically there are far too many appendectomies done in mental institutions during this time, and it seems that many of these were surreptitious sterilizations.
Now, all of this grows out of eugenics, which was something that was come up with by a cousin of Charles Darwin.
Yes, his cousin, Francis Galton, a very interesting and colorful man who was a world-famous explorer at the time. He was like a Renaissance man, a jack of all trades. He discovered the anticyclone because he would always do maps, and he discovered these anomalies. And he took his cousin's theory after he read On the Origin of Species, and he just started contemplating, well, how does intelligence evolve? And that's where he came up with the idea to try to breed intelligence and get rid of stupidity.
Well, he traveled all around the world.
He did.
And of course, Darwin came up with his idea after going on a ship voyage around the world. Did that affect Galton's thinking?
Absolutely. And he wrote a letter to his cousin and said, you know, your book has revolutionized my thought. And he's in middle age now. He's in his 40s, and you know, he has a whole wild life behind him of travels and debauchery. And here he settles down and starts to find his life's work. And as kind of, I don't want to call him an amateur scientist, but he certainly wasn't a brilliant scientist, but he had an innovative idea.
He had a particular fondness for women in Africa and the Middle East. Do you think that even though he was attracted to them, that he considered these foreign women biologically inferior
to the
women back home in England?
Yeah, absolutely. And apparently at the time, during British colonialism, that many young British aristocrats would go off and sow their wild oats in Beirut or in Africa, and it was almost a culturally encouraged thing to do.
We have any idea of how Darwin regarded eugenics?
He wrote a letter to Galton, and he and his son had read his new book about eugenics, and they both said, wow, you know, this book is blowing our minds, in a sense. And Darwin said that, I had always believed that people, it was either hard work, you know, you're either stupid or brilliant based on your hard work, but your book has completely made a believer out of a skeptic.
Well, that's interesting because the survival of the fittest suggests that there's a natural weeding out.
Mm-hmm.
And Dalton would say that that's not true. He would have said that people who are less intelligent are likely to have more children and there would be a natural diminishment.
Yes. And this survival of the fittest comes from Herbert Spencer, not Darwin.
And social but Darwinism.
But at the time, the eugenics really took hold among the charities and corrections. And they felt that, and Spencer was one of the main people who would say this, that our altruism, our helping out the poor, you know, our helping them survive is actually leading them to reproduce and breed, and soon we're going to be overwhelmed. And you see that in Oliver Wendell Holmes' Supreme Court case. He says, rather than to allow ourselves to become swamped with incompetence, it's better to sterilize these people. So there was a fear that our Christian altruism, that our charities and corrections, that our system was wrong. And so they wanted to apply science, a new kind of scientific planning to social welfare, as it were. And when, of course, Spencer's idea was to just let them die and not help them out at all and let nature take its course. But that would be the laissez-faire version of eugenics, whereas the progressives in the early 20th century thought we should take control of our evolution, we should use science to create a more perfect human species.
But despite the fact that we have all these British supporters, Darwin's son, Major Leonard Darwin, mm-hmm. was the first president of he was the president of the first International Eugenics Congress in London in 1912. You have Herbert Spencer. You have H.G. Wells, as I said, George mm-hmm. Bernard Shaw, Winston Churchill.
He was there as well.
Still, it did not take off in England. It really took off in the United States.
Yes.
Why?
Well, that's a difficult and complex question, and it probably has a series of answers. I wanted to point out that it was in the United States where we have this this drive towards perfection since the time of the Puritans, and almost a Jeremiad warning that if we don't keep ourselves pure, both morally and physically, that our country will decline. So there was almost an American mindset to do it. And as well as our technological innovations, we had the technology. We devised sterilization as a surgical procedure. And so it was more of the debate was more centered legally here in the United States than it was in England.
And where did the first sterilizations take place?
In Indiana. The first law was passed in 1907 in Indiana, but there were sterilizations before that and castrations as well. But the first law, the first legal forced sterilization statute in human history was in Indiana in 1907.
And then how many states wound up adopting sterilization laws?
I've seen figures from 30 states to 33 states. I say at least 30 states. There may have been a few others at different times.
That was a 30 out of 48, in other words.
Yes,
a great majority there.
The great majority.
And there were also eugenic marriage laws, which are separate from miscegenation.
They were.
Laws. What did they
In create? Many states, you had to get a certificate of eugenic health before you could get a marriage certificate. And there's some court cases where, you know, judges would deny two people who wanted to get married because they thought you'll just produce children that will lead to more poverty and lead to more crime.
Well, the big surprise is that not just those people I mentioned, but some people we associate with very progressive ideas.
Absolutely.
It was like the suffragists and women's rights activists.
Yeah.
They supported eugenics and sterilization.
Many did.
Why?
Many did. It was part, in some ways, eugenics gave women as the carriers of the germplasm, the one who would actually produce children, it made them important in society. So many progressive women in the late 19th century and early 20th century saw eugenics as an affirmation of their of their fitness, and how it's a two-way street. It's not just the male's genes, it's ours as well. So, you know, women are co-equal partners in producing a good breed of people.
And Teddy Roosevelt and Woodrow Wilson, political
yes.
Rivals,
yes.
They both supported it.
Yeah. Wilson, when he was governor of New Jersey, passed a forced sterilization law.
But he was quite religious. Wouldn't he have had some qualms?
In Protestantism, and especially in theology at the time and in biblical studies, there was a revolution going on. And the term fundamentalist comes from a series of pamphlets called The Fundamentals of a Reaction in the Presbyterian Church between modernists and conservatives. And so in modern Protestant thought, they were often big supporters of science and of Darwin. And so you found most... most progressive Christians, progressive Protestants, I should say, very much enthusiastically for this. And if I could say one more thing, there's also a theology called postmillennialism at the time, which thought that they should usher in the great thousand years of Christ. And so they thought this was one way to bring the perfection of Christ's second coming in the society of the time.
I hope I didn't give the impression that all the names that I mentioned were supporting sterilization. Someone like George Bernard Shaw was a supporter of what was called positive eugenics.
Yes, yes.
And many of these others felt mm-hmm. that too. They subscribed to some of the ideas of eugenics mm-hmm. as scientific, but didn't necessarily think that mm-hmm. sterilization was yeah. the way to go.
And Alexander Graham Bell, too, he eventually broke ties with the movement in the 1920s when he saw sterilization becoming the focus and rather becoming a better breeding program to encourage the breeding of the fit. And
where did FDR stand on this?
This came much later. In my research, eugenics, it was during the Depression was a time, too, where eugenic sterilization sort of took, the back seat.
But
to
he
other
was the
more
governor
of
New York
issues.
Before that.
Yes. I don't believe he was the one that passed the law in New York, that signed the bill into law. But it certainly wasn't Teddy Roosevelt was very interested in this. But FDR had other issues
Did eugenics come up in the Scopes trial?
It was lurking in the background. It certainly wasn't full front and center in the Scopes trial. But when William Jennings Bryan, a lot of his objections to evolution was less scientific than it was the moral repercussions and the implications of Darwinism. That's why he fought against it so vehemently.
My guest is Harry Brunius, who is a frequent contributor to the Christian Science Monitor, a professor of journalism at Hunter College and the founder of the Village Quill. His book, Better for All the World, The Secret History of Forced Sterilization and America's Quest for Racial Purity, is published by Knopf. We will continue our conversation after this.
WNYC is supported by Primary Stage's production of A Safe Harbor for Elizabeth Bishop, Martha Goes play about the Pulitzer Prize-winning poet with Amy Irving at 59 East 59 Theaters. Tickets at 212-279-4200. Cultural colleague Dehesh Museum of Art, now showing Stories to Tell, an exhibition celebrating the golden age of American illustration at 56th and Madison, DeheshMuseum.org and 212-759-0606. Freelancers Union at Working Today, a nonprofit providing health insurance and other benefits to qualifying freelancers and the self-employed in select industries. Information at freelancersunion.org.
From George Jones and Tammy Wynette to Mariah Carey and Snoop Dogg, some of the best music has been made by pairs. Today on Soundcheck, John Schaefer speaks with Anthony DeCurtis of Rolling Stone magazine about what it makes to create a great duo. That's today at 2 on 93.9 WNYC. We're back with Harry Bruinius, Bruinius. His book, Better for All the World, The Secret History of Forced Sterilization and America's Quest for Racial Purity, which is published by Knopf. We talked earlier about the Supreme Court case, Buck versus Bell. Let's talk a bit about Carrie Bell, whose sterilization case reached the Supreme Court. What did her family history look like?
Well, she was reared in poverty. Her mother had she was Carrie Buck was not born out of wedlock, as was claimed by at the trial. But afterwards, when Carrie Buck's father either killed in an accident or he simply abandoned his family, left his mother to fend for herself. During this time where you just had charities and corrections, and she was kind of dependent on the haphazard aid that was available to her in Charlottesville, Virginia. And she ended up having two more children out of wedlock, so she was sort of targeted when they were caught up in this new quest to revise social welfare laws at the time. And so she was sort of a typical poor family, both Emma and Carrie Buck at the time.
It's ironic that she was from Charlottesville, which is just down the road from where Woodrow Wilson comes from. Did she want to be sterilized?
Absolutely not. We rarely hear her voice in the hearings when she was brought before. And this was an intentional test case. It was meant to be brought to the Supreme Court. So the administrators of the Virginia colony, in effect, sued themselves and used Carrie to bring their new law to the Supreme Court and to the state courts as well. So she makes very few statements in her hearing, and her attorney was part of the conspiracy, as it were.
Were any of the people who were sterilized offered incentives to do it?
They didn't need to, because they only had to. It was a kangaroo court that they had to go through, and the incentive were in other states where they weren't necessarily forced sterilization. Technically, they had to have the family consent to it. But what they would do is say, okay, your child has this feeble-mindedness illness, and they can either A, spend the rest of their lives in a mental institution, or become sterilized and be released. Those were the choices, which isn't much of a choice, of course. And so that's in many states. That's how sterilization was administered.
So you said earlier the Jews and African Americans weren't targeted.
Not directly, no.
But the Nazis looked at this and saw an answer to some of their problems, didn't they? How much did they really look into American eugenics laws and the forced sterilizations?
I believe the analogy or that the connection can be taken too far. Germany had their own indigenous eugenics research programs since the time of the 19th century. At the first International Eugenics Congress, they had their own displays and presentations. So it wasn't simply that, oh, look what the Americans are doing, let's do the same thing. You see them after the Nazis took control in 1933, one of the first laws they passed was a sterilization law. And in my research, one of the most fascinating things I found was when they published the law, they cited the California sterilization law as an example of what they were trying to do. So right from the beginning, probably for propaganda purposes because they knew it would be controversial, they cited the examples of the United States. And interestingly enough, in the Nuremberg trials, when sterilization became an issue as one of the things that they were accused of with genocide, they simply pointed out, look at the marriage restriction laws in the United States, look at the forced sterilization laws in the United States. Our Nuremberg Code wasn't necessarily that different from the laws that were, you know, with the main Allied prosecutors.
You get the feeling that some of the Americans pushing for this had their own version of a final solution in mind. Harry Lachlan wanted forced segregation of the socially unfit, and estimated 10% of the population needed to be sterilized. Who was he?
Harry Lachlan was a high school teacher in Missouri, And he took a class here in New York in Cold Spring Harbor and became friends with Charles Davenport. And Charles Davenport eventually asked him to come up and help him start this new eugenics record office.
Now, Charles Davenport was a Brooklyn-born eugenicist?
Yes, yes.
Now, he had his own problems, didn't he? Would he have worried at all when his daughter became a flapper in Greenwich Village and then married at least one Jewish immigrant, maybe
yes.
two, this probably would have horrified him.
I think this is the main thing that my book is about, the ironies of human longing. And even more ironic than his daughter marrying a Jew was his son, who he loved dearly. And he had written in his book, Heredity in Relation to Eugenics, that it's not necessarily diseases that kill us. It's a genetic weakness, or else we would all die. So there's the strong, and then there's the weak. And it turned out that his son contracted polio and within a matter of days died. And in another twist of irony, he had a nervous breakdown, and he and his wife needed to retire to an asylum for weeks to recover from the loss of their child, their only son.
So he should have had himself sterilized.
According to his own logic, yes. And as Harry Laughlin as well, it turns out at the end of his life, he either had it for a while and hid it or developed it later in life, but he was having grand mal seizures in the laboratory, and he was an epilepsy was one of the things, one of the prominent things on his list to be sterilized. And of course, a lot of these institutions were called, you know, the Virginia Colony for Epileptics and Feeble-Minded. So epilepsy was deemed one of those main genetic markers for people who would pollute the gene pool.
I prevented you from telling us who Harry Laughlin was.
Yeah.
He was an important man in America, wasn't he?
Yeah. Harry Laughlin is one of the characters, and I was very, I try to be sympathetic to a lot of my characters, but Harry Laughlin was an angry man. He never had children. We're not quite sure why, whether he chose to or whether he couldn't, but he became a vehement proponent of sterilization, and this was his life's work. He studied it more than anyone else. He studied the laws, and he came up with, after seeing why so many laws were being deemed unconstitutional in states before 1927, he wrote a model law that would deal with the due process issues that a lot of the laws were being struck down with. So he wrote a model law, which eventually became the model for states all around the country and then for many countries, including the Nazi law. And in fact, the Nazi law was less stringent than Harry Laughlin's model law was. But they're very similar. And Harry Laughlin said that it almost seems like it's word for word based on my own model law.
And you include in this book some of the advertising campaigns mm-hmm. that were promoted to support eugenics. Some people are born to be a burden on the rest
yes.
is the theme on one. And then it says, this light flashes every 15 seconds. Every 15 seconds, $100 of your money goes for the care of persons with bad heredity, such as the insane, feeble-minded criminals and other defectives.
Yes.
Now, I hate to say this, but I suspect there are some people who would see these things right now and say, let's go back. Or are there sterilizations still occurring? Because I suspect many of the sterilization laws were never repealed.
Many of them were not. They're not explicitly enforced or practiced right now. But every once in a while, you will see a judge, a mother will come before him that has had six children, and he'll say, either go to jail or get sterilized. And so you do see here, I've read a few.
And then there's a public outcry.
Yes.
And it doesn't happen.
Yeah.
But it did occur until the 70s.
Yes.
Where was that happening in the 70s?
Well, Virginia and North Carolina had had many. They were probably the leaders in sterilizations after World War II. And we don't quite know. One of the reasons this is a secret history is that all of the records of the tens of thousands of people who were sterilized remain sealed for privacy reasons. And so researchers aren't able to actually go through their medical records and see why exactly were they chosen to be sterilized. And so in the chapter about Colorado in my book, Colorado was one of the states that did not pass a sterilization law. In fact, they had rejected it on five separate occasions, either in the legislature or a veto by the governor. Yet the hospital in Denver was, in Pueblo, I mean, was sterilizing dozens, if not hundreds, of people for eugenic reasons. And this came out in one of the cases that I discovered. And so we don't know.
But you had records there.
I did have records in that one. That was one where they were, since it was a legal court case, that her medical records were in the file.
Now, are there records still that could be unsealed?
Oh, absolutely. There are tens of thousands.
You'd think by now we could change that. After all, the Freedom of Information Act has revealed so many other things.
Not when it comes to a person's private medical records. I had tried to get the records of Carrie Buck for months before I got to them, because the law was being changed in Virginia, and they have very strict rules. If there are any next of kin, they have to consent to let you see them. In the case of Carrie Buck, she had no kin, so according to the new law, researchers were allowed to see her medical records.
Could you put on your headphones, because we're going to take a call now. My guest is Harry Bruinius, Bruinius. His book From Knopf is called Better for All the World, The Secret History of Forced Sterilizations and America's Quest for Racial Purity. And we go now to Martin from the west side of Manhattan. Hi, Martin.
Hi. I found your discussion most interesting, and it recalled that during the early 1990s, I learned through a consultation visit to the Ministry of Public Health in Korea, that sterilization was still occurring among patients with mental illness in institutions in Korea. And folks there were surprised to learn that this was considered unethical and the practice was stopped. And when I tried to find out about that, they thought it had come about during the period when Korea was occupied by Japan and influenced by the Nuremberg laws. When I visited Japan, I learned that sterilization was not being done in Japan, but may have been done prior to 1945.
Yes, the eugenics and forced sterilization was a global campaign. In these international conferences of eugenics, you see many countries getting these ideas and bringing them back. India, before World War II, had a very large forced sterilization campaign. And, of course, Denmark and Canada and Finland and many other countries began to pass forced sterilization laws after all of these conferences around the globe. And, I'm not that familiar with the laws that were in Asia, but I know that eugenics and forced sterilization did become a global campaign, not simply in the United States or in Germany.
But what Martin is suggesting is that it still occurs in some parts of the world. Were you able to meet any of the people who had undergone forced sterilization?
Yes, there's a chapter in my book where I discovered a woman in Colorado who had been sterilized in 1941 against her will when she was 17 years old, and she's still alive today. And the reason I was able to find her was the fact that she had sued the state of Colorado and the hospital and the doctors that sterilized her in the late 1950s. And her case was eventually, it wasn't thrown out, but in another irony of the story was the jury felt that she was mentally competent and smart, so she had passed the statute of limitations, even though she was legally considered insane. And so if you just went on the straight,
you had her coming and going there.
Yeah.
Well, has anybody won one of these cases?
No. Either because of the precedent set by Buck v. Bell or because of technicalities in the case itself, there are issues, again, of you know, of the statute of limitations and whether or not you can sue for civil damages after 15, 20 years. And so there's never been any, that I'm aware of, any monetary damages that were given to. In 1980 in Virginia, there was a class action suit against the state, and it was settled out of court eventually. But the case was ruled due to Buck v. Bell that, you know, the state had done nothing illegal. But I think at the time in 1980, the state of Virginia still recognized that there was something there, that they were wronged. So they were given free counseling and free medical help for anything that had occurred as a result of their sterilizations. But hundreds, if not thousands, of people were sterilized in Virginia. And this case in 1980 was one instance in which they received some sort of compensation, but and, certainly not monetary.
And 65,000 over the course of two-thirds mm-hmm. of the 20th century. My guest, Harry Brunius, will be giving a talk this coming Tuesday, the 21st, at 7 o'clock at the KGB Bar on East 4th Street. That's between 2nd and 3rd Avenues. Also on April 2nd, details on that event can be found on our show page at WNYC.org. His book, Better for All the World, The Secret History of Forced Sterilization and America's Quest for Racial Purity, is published by Knopf. And I want to thank you so much for being my guest today.
It was my pleasure. Thank you for having me.
On tomorrow's show, a look at the underreported issues surrounding climate change, from exploding beetle populations in the West to its impact on the financial sector, plus a true story about survivors of a World War II U-boat attack, and Robert Drouin, one of the most respected winemakers of the Burgundy region, also the economics of abortion. The Leonard Lopate Show is produced by Melissa Egan with Sarah English, Brenna Farrell, and Blakeney Schick. We had help today from Melody Lee, Virginia Doris, and Brian Levinson. Debbie Darcy was at the audio controls. I'm Leonard Lopate, your host. I'll see you tomorrow.